text. I know that there's probably a few of you here who speak Sanskrit, so I don't want to embarrass you. Okay, then a certain Brahmin went to visit the Buddha, and then having approached the Buddha, he exchanged pleasant greetings with him, and then he sat down on one side. Seated at one side, that Brahmin said to the Buddha, so Venerable Gautama is the one who acts the same as the one who experiences. Sa karoti sa pratisangvedayati. Okay, so you can see this is virtually identical with the Pali text. In fact, it is identical. It's just in Sanskrit form rather than Pali. But the answer that the Buddha gives is slightly different. Instead of saying that this is one extreme, the Buddha says, avyakritang idang brahmana maya sakaroti. So this is undeclared by me, okay, or unanswered by me, whether one who acts is the same as the one who experiences the result of that action. And goes on. So well then, Master Gautama is the one who acts completely different from the one who experiences. And then the Buddha says, this also is unexplained by me or unanswered by me, whether what that one who does is completely different from the one who experiences. And then the Brahmin then answers, since now you say that both of these things are undeclared or unexplained, what then is the meaning? How then should we see the meaning of the what the Buddha has said? And the Buddha goes on and says, if we say that the one who acts is the one who experiences Brahman, then this is sasatavada, this is eternalism. And if we say that one who acts is completely different from one who experiences, this is annihilationism. Okay, and avoiding these two extremes, the Buddha taught the Dhamma by the middle way and then goes on to teach dependent origination as normal. So you can see that even though it's a little bit different in the phrasing, but at the end it comes to that same idea that these are two extreme views. And one of the differences here is that it actually identifies those two views. So the idea that I do a deed and I'm the same person who experiences it, this is what we call eternalism. Right? So eternalism is essentially the theory of a soul or a self, right? The idea that there is some eternal essence of what it means to be me, right? I do this deed and in the future life I will be born and that same self, identical with who I am, will experience that result. And the other extreme, that there's complete difference or complete separation, is called annihilationism. So what I am now, that will come to an end, right? Usually, most forms of annihilationism, what it means is at the end of your life, okay? So at the end of your life, you die, and there's nothing else will happen. So if there's any results of my deeds after that, somebody else will experience the results of that, okay? But I won't experience it. That's the most common form of annihilationism. There are other forms, but that's the one we're most familiar with. And of course, these correspond more or less to what we would usually consider to be a religious point of view on one side, right? The idea that you have an eternal soul which goes to heaven and so on, and a scientific materialist worldview on the other hand, which is that we're just made up of material elements and then when we die, there's nothing remaining from that. So these are those two extremes. So notice how the Buddha saw these things as being two parts, two sides of the same coin. And to me, this is very interesting, his approach with this. Because we can see in our world today that that these two extremes still very much exist, don't they? And that we have a world where so many people seem to be dogmatically committed to one point of view or the other out of these, right? That either this is true or that is true, and in some cases there's just this sort of irreconcilable conflict that arises from that. Right? I mean, a good example of that is in the context of the ethics of abortion, for example, right? If you take an eternalist point of view, you believe that when a child is conceived, that the child has a soul, and that soul is eternal. So that soul is essentially the same as the soul that you or I have. And so killing that child is the same as killing an adult, and therefore it's murder, and we have to stop it under any circumstances. On the other hand, if you believe in a materialist point of view, then you'll say that, well, a child, when it's just conceived, doesn't have a brain, it doesn't have a nervous system, it doesn't have any way of experiencing suffering, so therefore, we shouldn't treat it as being an organism that has an independent or inherent right to life or right to exist, and so that it has no moral consequence to terminate that life. And so when you have these points of view which are based on such very different theoretical foundations, then it's virtually impossible to find any reconciliation or any way of dealing with that. So from a Buddhist point of view, what I would say, how we would approach that question, again, we always use this idea of the middle way, right? So in the context of dependent origination, when a child is conceived in the womb, that there is a connection with a consciousness, right? So there is, a consciousness is part of what participates in that. And we'll be looking at some suttas later that talk about that in more detail, right? But consciousness is not consciousness, okay? Your consciousness is different from the consciousness of a worm, or which is different from the consciousness of a fish. Right? Consciousness is not one unitary thing, and so we don't necessarily regard termination or killing of life or having an abortion as being of the same ethical level as killing an adult human being, right? Even if there's consciousness involved, it's not the same kind of consciousness as an adult human being does. And the Buddha talks about this all the time in the suttas, and we'll see this in the suttas, how consciousness grows and develops and matures, right? It's not the same thing. And so even though you can say, well, look, we should give careful ethical consideration to that, but it's not the same thing as killing a human being. It's not the same thing as murder. And so this is the one way, and that's just one example, but it's, I think, a very practical and important example of how this teaching on the middle way is not just a theoretical teaching, but actually, I think, opens the way towards a much more balanced, much more moderate, and much more reasonable way of approaching a lot of the kinds of ethical and philosophical problems which we seem to be very dogged with in this world we live in today. Okay, any questions on that before we move on? What does the Agama say? We can look at it if you want. You're right? You're kidding? Okay. Like I said, almost always the Agama will be pretty much identical with the Sanskrit text. Yeah.
Being once is in the world is a product of all the perceptions, conditionings, and all the things that tie in with dependent origination. Mm. That's what makes that life.
Yeah. And you think about one of the things that the Buddha used as a simile. I might come back to that later, because there's a lot of the similes we're going to be looking at which are actually quite relevant for that. Yeah. Okay. So we can see that even within such a simple sutta as this, we're already seeing some very, very profound and very powerful ideas, which are sort of packed up in there. Just not sure how much to talk about right now, but just one other detail that I'll just mention here briefly is that down the bottom here in the Sanskrit text, we have a little passage which is commonly found in Pali, but which was actually missing from this particular Pali text. Asmin sati idang bhavati. Asmin sati idang hoti in Pali. This being, that is. This arising, that arises. This is the summary form of dependent origination. This being, that is, this arising, that arises. And then we have the inverse for the cessation part, but that's abbreviated in this current text, that the inverse will say, when this is not, that is not. When this ceases, that ceases. I'm going to come back to this phrase a little bit later on. Again, it's a phrase which sounds almost too obvious to need mentioning, but in fact is very profound. And one final point I'll make before moving on from this sutta, this notion of something being unexplained, of avyākataṁ, a concept also found commonly in the Pali texts. And it's just worth mentioning in passing here that it's not uncommon to find that people will say that the Buddha refused to take a dogmatic stand on things, or that he refused to answer metaphysical questions, and so on and so forth. And people sometimes seem to be saying that this is a kind of definitive characteristic of the Buddha's teachings, and that's quite a serious misrepresentation of how the Buddha taught. The Buddha gave clear, straightforward, and definitive answers to lots and lots and lots of questions, right? But he would carefully distinguish that there are certain kinds of questions to which it's not useful to give any kind of answer, okay? And so the Buddha analyzed the different kinds of questions, some of which you answer directly, some of which you should answer only by analysis, some of which you should not answer, and so on. So there are different kinds of questions. So it's not as if it was the Buddha's policy to just not give answers to things. On the contrary, most of the time, he would always give straightforward answers to things. But there are a few cases where he say, talking about this or getting is just going to get us messed up in a lot of philosophical problems, or is going to lead to misleading conclusions, and so on and so forth. And so there are some kinds of questions which it's best, which the Buddha didn't directly answer.
I mean, regarding such questions that the Buddha refuses to answer, I mean, one that's closest to my heart is obviously the question of, I mean, there's a very common question, even during the time of the Buddha, whether the world is finite or infinite, or whether it's neither finite nor infinite, and he emphatically refused to answer that. However, I do know that this is one of the most fundamental questions in physics, and people spend their career and their life and generations on this and keep pursuing and meticulously measuring the universe to attempt to answer such questions. So could you please reconcile this? I mean, it seems as if we believe that there must be a way to answer it, and we are coming close.
What's to reconcile? The physicists haven't found an answer.
But they are,
if they read what the Buddha said, they wouldn't have bothered.
Yeah, sure, but we are getting closer and closer, and we are getting more and more experimental evidence, right? So what are we missing?
First of all, the Buddha doesn't say, to say that the Buddha doesn't answer it doesn't mean to say that it doesn't have an answer. It just means the Buddha doesn't think it's worthwhile giving an answer. Yeah. So, but personally, I think that's a question I don't think we're really ever going to have an answer to. Personally, basically, the problem is that you can only see as far as the next horizon. That's it. So all you can say is that there's a horizon over there and I can't see past it. Is there anything past it? Who knows? You know, and this has happened so many times in science that everyone says, no, there's nothing past that horizon. Then someone builds a bigger telescope. Oh, whoops, yes, there is something past that.
Yeah, for sure.
And but I agree. It is a fascinating question. So what can I say? Yeah. Okay. That's a slightly different question. So the question on whether the universe is infinite is a question of spatial dimension, and a question on whether it has a beginning is dimension in time. Of course, depending on how you see your physics, you could say it's ultimately the same question. Right? But again, it's the same point. To say it has no discernible beginning is just exactly what I was saying, that it's past the horizon. Right? There's no, as if the, no matter how far you look, you can't see a beginning. And that's really all we can say.
So Buddha really answered what he said was others not to get confused about those things by going to look at it.
Yeah, it's long enough. Okay, let's do a few minutes of meditation. Okay, so let's move along to another sutta. And this one is the Bhava Sutta of the Anguttara Nikaya. As you can see, it has a one Chinese parallel. And unfortunately, we didn't have a translation online for this, so I'll just read through it in Pali. Then, Venerable. Oh, we had translation, but not a translation on Sutta Central, I think. Anyway, then Venerable Ananda approached the Buddha, and having approached the Buddha, he sat down to one side. Seated at one side, Venerable Ananda said to the Buddha, Bhava, Bhava, Bhante, Bhava, life, existence, being, is said. What do we mean when we're talking about life? Literally, to what extent is there existence, or what is the sphere or the domain of existence? But what it actually means, this a little idiom in Pali, it means what does it mean when we're talking about existence or life? Usually the word bhava is translated as existence these days, which isn't a bad translation. But often, as we'll see, it means more or less what we mean by when we say life, as in my past life I was this, in my future life I was that, and so on. So the Buddha's response. Kama dhatu vepa kanchananda kamang nabhavisa apinukho kama bhavo panyayata. Which means, when if Ananda, there was no kama, there's no acts to ripen in the sense sphere world, then would there be any life in the sense sphere or existence in the sense sphere? Okay? I'll come back to that sentence in a little while. It takes a bit of unpacking. No he tam bhante. No, that's not the case, bhante. Thus, Ananda, karma is the field. Okay? Karma is the field. Consciousness is the seed. Craving is the snot. Well, etymologically, it's from the same root as snot, okay? So who am I to argue with etymology? Okay, perhaps not, okay. Just in this case, it means craving is the moisture, the dew, the moisture. For beings who are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, consciousness is established, or perhaps better, even planted in an inferior realm, a lower realm. Consciousness is planted in a lower realm. Thus, there comes to be ayating puna bhavavinibhati. There comes to be the, in the future, repeated, renewed life and rebirth. Okay, so this just being a sort of a complicated phrase to mean this is how you get reborn in the future. Ayating puna bhavavinibhati. Okay, so let's just have a little closer look at this particular phrase. This is one of the most, my favorite little passages on this teaching that we find in the suttas. Okay, so the first part, kama dhatu vepa kanchananda kamang. Okay, so this is kamang, right? Kama, acts, ethical acts, which will be ripened, vepaka, in the kama dhatu. So notice that this word, don't be confused, kama here means sensual. Okay, and it's a different word from kamma, with two M's here. Okay, in Sanskrit, this one is karma. Okay, so you may have heard of the Kama Sutra, which tells you about all of the fun things you know you can't do in Buddhism, right? And that's this kind of karma, Kama Sutra. You'd be interested to know that there is, in fact, a Kama Sutra in early Buddhist texts as well. Do you know about that? Yeah, we have our own Kama Sutra. It's a little bit different from the famous one that you might have heard. Just a little bit different. Right. It's not so much on the how do you get to enjoy lots of different fun sex positions, and more about, yeah, if you enjoy these things, it's going to lead you into suffering. So it's a bit of a downer. But anyway, okay, moving along. Okay, so these are two different words, important to distinguish that. Karma, sensual. In this case, karma dhatu means the sense sphere world. And the karma dhatu means any of those kinds of rebirth which are associated with the experiences of the senses. So it means the human realm, the animal realm, any of the lower realms, and all of the heaven realms as well, right? So the gods in Buddhism are felt to be very kind of sensual beings, and they're all up there kind of dancing around and all of this kind of stuff. So it's very broad, the karma dhatu. So if there isn't any karma, if you don't make any acts which lead to rebirth in that realm, then could there be known, panyayeta, could there be a making known of this sensual life? Okay? In other words, would sensual life be found, or would it exist? So the point here, right, that the sensual sphere, the karma bhava, only exists because there are beings which are creating that karma to be reborn in there. So if you don't make that act, then that rebirth in that realm isn't going to happen. And thus, Ananda, and the Buddha goes on, kamang ketang. Okay, so kamma, not karma. Kamma ketang is karma is the field. So your acts are the field. And images are very useful and very profound and very important ones. Notice that in the Buddha's time, as we've seen, it was very much an agrarian culture. So the basic job of most people most of the time, go out in the field, you know, do the work, hoe the ground and plant the seeds and all of those things. That's what they were doing. That was their work. That was their karma, right? It's the word karma means work. So if you're going to say, I'm going to go and do my karma, I'm going to go to work today, I'm going to go and do my karma today, what it means for most people is going out and working on the fields. So kamang ketang, and this is what this kind of means. But it's even more important than that. If you look historically, this notion of rebirth, one of the main sources for the notion of rebirth in cultures seems to have been the observation of plant life, and especially the observation of crops. Okay, and you think about it, the whole idea, the ethical implications of rebirth and karma, right? The whole idea is that I'm going to not have this bit of fun right now because I'm going to get something that's even more pleasant in the future, right? And that's exactly the same logic that we have to use in order to plant crops, okay? I have got this perfectly good grain which I could cook up today and eat it and give to my family, but instead I'm going to take it, I'm going to throw it on the ground, right? Because I have faith that next year, right, I'm going to get even more that comes up from it. Right? You think about what an incredible revolution that takes to do that. How much you have to have that kind of positive reinforcement, how much confidence you have to have in the cycles of nature, right? To be able to believe that this is actually going to work, right? You have to get all of this stuff and literally just throw it away. I mean, it's crazy, right? Isn't it? It's crazy. You get perfectly good food. It's hard to get good food. And then just throw it on the ground because I have confidence that next year we'll have even more, right? And that's the same logic which applies in the realm of karma. So this idea of the seed and the field and all of those things is very closely intertwined with the very notion of karma as found not just in Buddhism but very widely as well. For example, the story of the death of Pythagoras. Have I told that story, the death of Pythagoras died? The legend was, now I cannot vouch for the truth of this legend, okay? Legend has it, because of course Pythagoras, like all of the ancient Greek philosophers, believed in rebirth, okay? And the legend has it that he was going to be killed by being chased by his enemies, okay? I don't know why they hated him, but anyway, that's the story. And he had to run across a field of beans to escape his enemies. But he refused to run across the field of beans, and he was caught and he was clobbered and he died there because he wouldn't cross the field of beans. Why would he not cross the field of beans? Well, You know what happens when you eat beans? Thank you for saying that so that I didn't have to. And so where do the farts come from? Oh, fools. That's the souls of the beings who are reborn in the beans. Okay? Right? So they come down, they get reborn, there's the little souls inside the beans. And so that when you eat, that's what they are. It's like the pranas, the energy. So that's why he wouldn't trample them. Anyway, just a little story there. Okay, so vijnanam bijam, consciousness is the seed. Okay, now. So what exactly is going on there with consciousness is the seed? And this is one of the most important images about consciousness that we find in the early Buddhist texts. Those of you who are some familiar with the Yogacara school of Mahayana Buddhism will know that they very frequently they talk of the what they call the alaya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. And the basic definition of the storehouse consciousness, it says it is sarva bijaka, literally is possesses all of the seeds. And so that image of the alaya vijnana is drawn directly from this particular passage. So what's going on? Consciousness is a seed, right? So you think about a seed. What's a seed? When you plant the seed, you have a little thing, a little nothing, right? You put it in the soil. Gradually it will grow, the moisture, all the different conditions come, and it will give rise to a new plant, right? Now, that new plant is not identical with the old plant, right? But it has a connection with it, right? It's not an identity, it's a relation. Right? We know that if you plant a mango seed, you're not going to get wheat. You're not going to get lemons. You can only get mangoes. How that tree will grow, it depends on all kinds of conditions, right? Is it going to grow tall or short? Is it going to have lots of fruit? Is the fruit going to be sweet? Depends on the weather and the soil and the bugs and all of those things. So you can't... It's not like a fixed relation. It's not a relation of identity, right? We saw that first sutta we said the Buddha rejected that relationship of identity. So karoti, so patisangvedaiti. It's not exactly the same. But neither is it completely different. Yeah, anyo karoti, anyo patisangvedaiti. It's related to, right? Dependent origination, okay? So consciousness is the seed. Now, that's a beautiful image and it's a very powerful image. But it, to me, it's one of the areas where the Buddha's teachings are actually even more sort of precisely illuminated with modern scientific knowledge. Right? Now we know more about what a seed is, and we can say, well, what's in the seed? The various different kinds of things, nutriments and so on. But the core, the thing that really carries the information in the seed is the DNA. Right? And so the DNA is made up of spirals of molecules, those molecules themselves made up of atoms, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, those atoms made up of nuclei, neutrons and protons and then electrons and so on down to quarks and strings or whatever you have and you disappear. Eventually we don't quite know what's going on. But all of those things, it's energies, right? All of those things is energies and it's patterns of energies. And what DNA does is it fixes patterns of energies in a way that can last for a long time. Right? And so the oldest DNA that we have, actually some of the oldest DNA that's been found has been found in WA. And it goes like millions of years, right? The DNA has been unchanged. It's something so small, right? Just a little molecule. It's so easy to damage or to whatever, but it replicates itself, it reproduces itself, it passes itself on. And there are two things that it needs to do that. One is it needs stability, right? But the second thing is it needs flexibility. It can't just be fixed, it can't be immutable. it must also relate, right? And DNA doesn't exist just by itself in a cell. DNA relates. DNA relates to RNA. It relates to all the proteins. It's part of an activity, which activities which are constantly going on in the cell, which are taking it apart, unzipping it, doing different functions on it, copying it and changing it and so on and so forth, not to speak of the mutations and so on that will happen as it gets reproduced and passed down through the years, through the generations. So DNA is not something which is fixed. DNA is something which is dynamic, and of course that's why we use the word evolving to talk about it. So that this is, we think of consciousness in very much the same way, right? It's just as the DNA ultimately is a pattern of energy, right? In the same way, consciousness is a pattern of energy, right? It's not something which is fixed. It's not identical, nor is it completely different, but it's related, okay? And so that evolving of that seed is very much like the evolving of the consciousness, yeah? And the Buddha used actually the phrase, the Sangvatthanika Vijnana, the evolving consciousness, okay? Now, so in the context of dependent origination and rebirth and so on, vijnana plays a decisive role. And it's vijnana which has experienced all of the karma, all of the deeds, all of the things that which are part of our life and which in a way can be considered as like the bearer of that information. Okay, so this is vijnanang bijang. And finally, we have tanha sneho. So craving is the moisture. And of course, here is another pun. All of these have some kind of pun in them some way. But craving, the word craving, we translate as craving is tanha. But of course, the root meaning of craving is thirst. Right? That's basically what it means, right? Trishna in Sanskrit is thirst. So thirst is the moisture. Okay, so a bit of a paradox there. But that word sneha in this case is it has a literal meaning of moisture, dampness or something, but also has an applied or metaphorical meaning to mean like attachment or affection or desire. So craving is the moisture. So these are some of the conditions which is necessary for life to grow. Right? And so you see how organic the imagery that the Buddha is using here. And so for beings who are hindered by ignorance, avijja nivaranang, and fettered by craving, tanha sanyojananang, then consciousness is planted in a lower realm, ahina dhatu. Okay, and this word patitang, very commonly used in this kind of context, and I mentioned before, usually translated perhaps overly literally as established. But I think in this context you could translate it as planted. Consciousness is planted in a lower realm. And frequently what it says is it'll be planted and then grows and matures and develops. So the sutta goes on and repeats the same pattern, not just for the sense sphere realm, but also for the rupa dhatu. Rupa dhatu being the rebirth in the they translate as form realm, but it means in the realm of the first four jhanas. And the last one is the arupa dhatu, the formless or incorporeal realm, the realm that's associated with the higher formless jhanas. So this is the Bhava Sutta, and it's one of the most important suttas dealing with the notion of bhava or existence in the suttas. When we talk about bhava, bhava is one of the links in dependent origination, but it's also important to bear in mind that bhava, in a sense, encompasses the whole of dependent origination, right? I mean, when they have the diagrams of dependent origination with the 12 links and so on that you see around, is the name of that is the bhava chakra, the wheel of life. Right? So dependent origination, bhava in one way, encompasses everything. Okay, so any questions on that? Alan, yeah. Microphone. Sorry?
Karma and Tanya are stored in, where is it?
Karma and what was the other one?
And Tanya.
Tanha.
Tanha, sorry. Hmm. Is stored in Vinana, correct? Well, in which kanda are
stored
are they?
In Vinyana, yeah.
In which kanda are they?
Yes, you can say that if you like, as long as you understand it's just a metaphor, yeah.
Yeah, because that's the beginning of the answer to the question I asked last time about where the past life are stored, that we can remember.
Oh, okay. So, and then I probably put you off and said we'll talk about it next time. But right, yeah. Excellent. So now I can't. Well, maybe next time we can. No. next lifetime we can talk about it. So where is it stored? I mean, in a sense, I think to talk. I mean, where is consciousness? I mean, I don't know if where is particularly apt question. But to me the thing to understand is that what's essentially going on. To me, it makes most sense if you think of it in terms of patterns, okay? So just like, or patterns or codes, right? You think DNA, essentially it's just a code, right? And once you think of it as a code and it's information, then the medium that code is transferred in is kind of irrelevant, right? So you could, in theory anyway, you could take the coding from a thing of DNA and you could express it in another form and you'd still have all of the information that's necessary. And of course, we're very familiar with doing that with computers and so on these days. It's basically what computers do is they transfer information from one form to another. So consciousness, I think, is similar. We think of it in terms of patterns, and those patterns are things like the different deeds we've done, the behaviours that we've done, and so on and so forth. And then these repeat, and these get reflected, and we feel these patterns coming up in our mind, don't we? I mean, we see the same thoughts come up again and again, the same behaviours come up again and again, and so consciousness has this kind of cyclic nature. And again, you know, this whole idea that it's evolving. So when the Buddha's positing that rebirth is a process of evolution and change, then it, as with all the Buddha's teachings, it's based on your ordinary everyday observation of what happens, right? It's not identical with me 5 minutes ago, but I'm not completely separate from me 5 minutes ago either. So it's about that connection. So consciousness is always is that pattern of connection. So they use similes in the various Buddhist texts as similes like the impression that a seal makes in the wax, for example, right? So you're making a letter or something and you want to, that you have a shape in your seal and you impress, so that the the deeds we do, the experiences we have is the seal, and the wax is the consciousness, right? And so it receives all of those impressions. So if we want to know, like, physically how that's kind of stored or anything like that, then my sense would be that there's probably, in a sense, it's device independent, right? You can install the same software on different operating systems. In other words, they've solved the problem that our IT guys have failed to solve over the years, that you can actually run the same software on different hardware, right? And so this is kind of what tends to be happening. So then if you ask a question, you know, where does this software live? It's kind of a bit of a moot point, isn't it? Well, it might live at the moment on this CD or this flash drive or something, but it doesn't inherently live anywhere. And it might inherently be expressed in a lot of different forms. And a good example of that is a recent technology which Google's done where you can use sound. So that your two computers can talk to each other instead of using Wi-Fi, can talk to each other using a speaker and a microphone. Okay, so it's the same information; it's just code being transferred from one place to another. But you can actually use a completely different medium to do that. The question that there is kind of one underlying medium of consciousness, I think, is a slightly misleading way of thinking about it. Yeah.
You're talking about is that I can't remember the other two. There's two other factors that I've heard have to go together with consciousness all the time. Is that kind of what you're talking about? That I think one of them was mentality and materiality. I can't remember what the other one was.
Yes, nama rupa is always goes together with consciousness. Yes.
Was there another one? Were there three?
Nama rupa and their friend Bob.
But is that what you're talking about? Like that's the thing.
Normally,
that
it's nama rupa and vinyana. That will actually come up later on in the class.
No,
yeah.
When you're talking about patterns and.
That's right.
Like
yeah.
That's part of that. Nama rupa is part of that, isn't it?
Yeah. So nama rupa is the active side. Is what's making the pattern. Okay. Yeah. That's the seal.
Okay.
And the vinyana is the wax.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Very basic question. When you're talking about consciousness or vinyana, are you talking about the six sense consciousnesses or combined? It's a sort of like a word to cover them all.
Yeah, no, and I'm not
about just mind consciousness.
Yeah, no. It's just ordinary sense consciousness. I mean, all of this rebirth process basically happens in mind consciousness. But of course, in early Buddhism, it really just talks about those six kinds of consciousness. But in the Yogacara tradition, it sort of split the Alaya Vijnana out and said this is like a seventh kind of consciousness. But it really is just a kind of mind consciousness. It's not a separate thing, really.
So what you're talking about here is a mind consciousness. Or
pretty much, yeah.
A set
yeah.
Mind consciousness. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Any more questions? Let's do a few minutes more meditation. Okay, moving along. So what I want to look at, Ananda, yeah, go on.
That the vijnana and the namarupa, they support each other. They are like two bamboo bundles supporting each other, and that also it's because they are being produced by these six production lines that the bhikkhuni mentioned. So what is the sort of because namarupa rupa cannot exist without the vijnana, vijnana cannot exist without the namarupa. Where is the sort of link, if you like? But the question is not coming correctly, I think.
We're going to be looking at that a little bit later on today. Maybe it'll be answered there. If it's not, then come back to me. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah? Okay, so I want to look at one more sutta before we go have our first break, and this is the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta. This is a long and most profound suttas in the canon, but we're only going to be looking at a small part of it. As we can see with this particular one, it has Pali, a Chinese version in the Madhyamagama, another Chinese version in the Ekottaragama. And finally, it has some SHT fragments. These SHT fragments are from the manuscripts found in Turfan. And if we had the internet, we could actually see this little fragment. So the gods have decreed we're not going to see that. Okay, moving on. Let's see what this discourse says, and I'm going to be racing a little bit through the text because there's a few bits that I want to focus on. Okay, but let's have a look at the setting. The Buddha was living in Sarvati, and a pernicious view had arisen in a bhikkhu named Sati, the son of a fisherman. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another. Okay? And the monks say, oh, that's terrible. You're distorting the Buddha's teachings. And the Buddha comes, asks Sati to come and see him. Now, when we see that particular phrase, it's a little bit like the one we looked at before with the Brahman. It's not entirely clear in the English translation why it's such a wrong view, because we've already seen the idea that consciousness is, the principle underlying rebirth. It doesn't sound that different to what Sati is saying. But when we look in the Pali, it becomes a little bit more clear. So the Pali, Tathāhaṃ bhagavatā dhammaṃ desitaṃ ajānāmi, as I understand the teachings of the Buddha, tadevidaṃ viññāṇaṃ, okay, tadeva, right? Sandhavanti saṃsarati ananyang. Okay, so it is that very same tadeva consciousness which wanders and roams through saṃsāra, not another. Okay, and this is an emphatic form. It's not exactly the same kind of emphatic form that we saw in the Brahman Sutta, but it's a similar idea that it's tadeva, exactly that same one. Exactly that same consciousness which roams through saṃsāra and not another. So again, he's proposing an eternalist view, right? The view that this consciousness is identical and goes through saṃsāra. And of course, the problem with this view is that it doesn't have any relation to experience. We never experience an eternal consciousness. All you ever experience is consciousness changing. So if we're going to call something consciousness, how can we call it consciousness if it's actually changing all the time? Consciousness by its very nature is changing, right? So if something is eternal, But how can it relate to that world of experience? You've got this huge metaphysical problem. How can an eternal consciousness relate to changing experience? And this is a big problem which those kind of theorists always run into. So anyway, the monks tell Sati off, and they take it to the Buddha. The Buddha calls Sati up to him, and he asks whether this is true, that he has this idea, and Sati says yes. And then the Buddha said, well, what is that consciousness? And Sati replies, Venerable Sir, it is that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. Okay, that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. So once again, doesn't sound too dissimilar on the surface of it to the Buddhist point of view, and yet the Buddha gives him a good ticking off about that. And here's the Pali of that text. That Bhante which speaks, Vado, Vedeo, experiences, Tatra, Tatra, here and there, is the idiom, but Tatra, Tatra usually has the idiomatic meaning of, in this kind of context, of in various states of rebirth, okay, so in various lives, experiences the good results of kalyana, papa, kama, good and bad deeds. Okay, so here comes again the ethical dimension, so we do ethical deeds. So once again, the problem here is that Sati is identifying it as that very same consciousness, whereas Buddha taught consciousness as dependently originated. So the Buddha's misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma in that way? Misguided man, have I not stated in many ways consciousness to be dependently arisen? But you, misguided man, have misrepresented us by your wrong grasp. So Sati must be feeling pretty low at this point in time. And then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus, what do you think? Has this Sati kindled even a spark of wisdom in this Dhamma and Vinaya? How could he, Venerable Sir? No, Venerable Sir. When this was said, the monk Sati, son of Bhishman, sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. Seems pretty heavy, doesn't it? Yeah? I mean, for something like that, I mean, he just had a, you know, a different idea about what consciousness was, but you know, it's clear his meaning to emphasize how important this distinction. It's a subtle distinction, but it's crucial. And if you don't understand this distinction, you'll always misunderstand this teaching of rebirth. And it's something which comes up again and again and again and again. People say, how, if there's no self, how can rebirth take place, right? How can there be rebirth without a self? And that is this is the answer. This is what the Buddha is saying. This teaching of dependent origination is the answer to that question. Rebirth takes place without a self because things are conditioned, because there is neither identity nor complete difference, because things evolve and change, because there are patterns which are recognizably similar, but they're not completely identical. That's how rebirth can happen. And one of the interesting philosophical outcomes of this Buddhist critique was that this was a very strong critique of Brahmanical views, and especially the view of the Atman. The idea, how can rebirth take place if there is a permanent self? I mean, you think about it. If there's something which is truly permanent, how can it participate in a process of rebirth? Rebirth is always changing, right? How are you going to get involved in karma, right? How can you be affected by karma? If you're affected, you're not permanent anymore. Right? So the idea that you have a permanent self which gets reborn, it just doesn't make any sense. Anything which is involved in experience has to be able to relate to and interact with that life. Otherwise, it's like just hermetically sealed off. It doesn't play any role. And the interesting thing was that after the Buddhist critique, a number of the more sophisticated of the Hindu philosophers essentially agreed with the Buddhist critique, and they said, yes, it's quite right. Rebirth is a process of impermanence, okay? It's a process of change, and it's not the Atman which takes rebirth, right? Because the Atman is permanent. So they still kept the idea that there is a self, there is an Atman, but it was completely separate from what happened when we're talking about rebirth, okay? And that's a very interesting philosophical position, because it actually acknowledges that when we think of the idea of permanence as a solution to the problem of rebirth, but in fact there's no solution at all. Okay, so the Buddha goes on, having reduced sati to a blubbering mess, goes on to teach the monks about dependent origination. And I won't go into all of these teachings on dependent origination, but just focus on one particular passage, or a couple of passages. First one that I can't omit because of how important it is. The Buddha says, monks, as purified and bright as this view is, if you adhere to it, cherish it, treasure it, and treat it as possession, would you then understand the Dhamma has been taught as similar to a raft for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping? Okay? So this is a beautiful simile, the simile of the raft. So the purpose of Dhamma is to cross over, not to get attached to it. Okay? One thing also just to remember about this, though, that this simile of a raft is sometimes also, I think, misrepresented. And so people sometimes think that means that, well, you shouldn't be attached to views and views of Buddhism and things like that. But it is important when using a raft to abandon it once one is actually on the far shore. When you're in the middle of the stream, they're quite useful. Okay? So if you're on the far shore, fine, right? But for those of us who are still putting our feet in on the near shore and thinking about launching out, then it's probably a good idea to hang on to the raft just for a little while. Okay? Okay. So, more on dependent origination, but the interesting bit, I want a couple of interesting bits here. So I mentioned earlier about the notion of the distinction between an ethical teaching and an existential teaching. Okay, and we've seen before the ethical dimensions mentioned in a few places, and the results of good and bad deeds and things like this. And here we find that the Buddha's focusing on that, the existential aspect of things. Okay, and this is precisely what we mean these days when you hear people, when we use the word like an existential crisis or something like that. And these are precisely the kinds of questions which people ask themselves, right? Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? What will I be in the future? What will I not be in the future? What shall we be in the future? How shall we be in the future? Having been what shall we become in the future? Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? Right? And so when we see these questions, right, of course these are exactly the questions that people ask themselves, right? Well, what's this all about? Where did I come from? What's my life? Who am I? What am I going to do? And we face these again and again and again and again, and we're always kind of looking for these answers, right? And of course the Buddha's here saying that once you've seen dependent origination, it's ultimately the solution to these kinds of existential angst and existential crises, right? That you know how things evolve, how things change, what's going on, how this all works. Another interesting passage is next. It says, knowing and seeing in this way, in other words, if you've seen dependent origination for yourself, would you say the teacher is respected by us? We speak as we do out of respect for the teacher. And the monks say, no, venerable sir. Okay? Again, very interesting, a very nice one. Yeah? So the monks, if they've actually seen the Dhamma, they don't say what they're saying because they respect the Buddha. They say what they say because they saw it for themselves. Yeah? Do you only speak of what you have known, seen, and understood for yourselves? Yes, Venerable Sir. And so you've been guided by me with this Dhamma, which is visible here and now, immediately of effective inviting inspection, onward leading to be experienced by the wise for themselves. For it is in reference to this that this has been said. Okay, so this is the basic passage on the recollection of the Dhamma. We just recited it this morning in the Dhana Sala. Svakkhato bhagavata dhammo sandiptiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pacchattang veditabo vinyuhi. And that's what it means, that you can see and realize it in this very life. And some of these phrases, again, are not quite as apparent in an English idiom as they are in the Pali, is visible here and now. Sandiptiko essentially means that it you can experience it in this very life. Right? That's what sandiptika means in the Pali. It's always used sandiptika in this life as opposed to samparayika in the next life. Right? Akalika, immediately effective. Right? That's quite a good translation. Sometimes they translate it as timeless, but timeless is not quite an accurate translation. Immediately effective, again, essentially being a synonym for sandiptika, meaning it will you can see the results of it in this very life. Right? In other words, you don't have to wait to be reborn in order to experience the results of it. You know for yourself. If you can abandon greed, hatred, and delusion in your own mind, then you know for yourself what that is like. Okay. And then it goes on to another interesting passage where it talks about consciousness and process of dependent origination through the process of birth and conception. And again, continuing that kind of organic, grounded aspect of dependent origination, and to sort of emphasize this, because sometimes when we're talking about dependent origination, sometimes it becomes a bit abstract, sometimes it's a bit philosophical, whereas the Buddha kept it kind of strongly rooted in these ordinary sort of organic and living processes. Okay, so the first part, the descent of the embryo takes place through the union of three things: the union of mother and father. And it goes through various cases when this doesn't work, but I'll just look at the last case when it does work. When there's union of mother and father, the mother is in season, i.e. if the mother is fertile. The Gandharva is present through the union of these three things. The descent of the embryo takes place. The descent of the embryo is not a really good translation. It just means the conception of the embryo. It's an overly literal translation there. And the Gandharva here is a... it's a bit of a complicated question in Buddhist studies, but anyway, what it means essentially is that there's a being or a consciousness which is ready to be reborn. I could go in quite some detail about that, but I don't want to spend too much time on this passage. Now, this is a well-known passage in Buddhism as talking about the process of rebirth, and so notice that it has the biological part, the presence of the parents and so on, but it also has the presence of a consciousness, which is something which is not part of what we normally think of in terms of biological conception. Even though this is a well-known passage within Buddhism, what's often much less known or acknowledged is that the suttas attribute this view to being a Brahmanical view. Okay, so in this context, it's being taught in a Buddhist context, but elsewhere in the suttas, we find the view being attributed to a group of Brahmins. Okay, it seems to have been a description of the process of rebirth, which the Buddha perhaps took over from a Brahmanical teaching. Okay, next part. Then the mother then carries the embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months with much anxiety as a heavy burden. At the end of 9 or 10 months, the mother gives birth with much anxiety as a heavy burden. And so here is a, perhaps I think somewhat rare in ancient literature, acknowledgement of the suffering and the difficulties that the mother goes through through the process of pregnancy. Usually when you read in ancient texts about birth and pregnancy and so on, they're usually written by blokes. And so they usually don't include very much acknowledgement of the experience of the woman who's the one who's actually most involved in the whole thing. So this is an acknowledgement of that. And then when the child is born, she nourishes it with her own blood, for the mother's breast milk is called blood in the noble one's vineyard. Yeah? And again, you know, an acknowledgement of the closeness and the sacrifice and that the mother does in order to raise the child. Of course, also being good biology, right? Breast milk or milk is very similar in composition to blood. Okay, so when he grows up and his faculties mature, the child plays at such games as toy plows, tip cat. What's tip cat? Sorry? Walking like a cat? Sorry? Tipka? Somebody said they thought... Sorry? What was it again? Okay. So they managed to make the game sound very boring. It is very precise, yeah. It's not like somebody when we did it in Sydney suggested it was like tipping cows, like people have this thing where you tip cows over, and they thought maybe it's tipping cats. I thought, you're never you're never going to tip a cat over. Okay, so tip cat somersaults, toy windmills, toy measures, toy cars, and a toy bow and arrow. And what's amazing to me about this list of childhood games is how little they've changed, right? I mean, kids play with exactly these same things today, right? There's more extensive lists of child games that we find in some places in the suttas. And again, you know, even some of them like mimicking deformities, for example. Not being a very politically correct game, but still being one which is very common that children do. And even this one, like the toy cars, probably, meaning toy carts might be a better translation, but even in the Indus Valley, 1,000 years, 1,500 years before the Buddha, one of the few artifacts that's recovered from the Indus Valley actually is toy carts. So, you know, kids were playing with those things even such a long, long time ago. No, I think you misunderstand. It was the girls who were playing with the bows and arrows and the toy carts. This is long before they started marketing the boys and girls toys as separate kind of things, yeah. From the Buddha's time, we don't actually have a lot, but from the Indus Valley, before the Buddha, you do find like little figurines of like dancing girls and things like that. So yeah, I mean, imagine there were different kinds of toys, but dolls, I'm not sure how much they'd survive that long time ago. Anyway, but that's what I reckon. I reckon that the girls were running around with the bows and arrows.
So Bhante, can I go back to the Gandhapa part? That does this passage support the idea that consciousness enters the womb at conception? Because it seems to say that it happens at the same time.
Right, okay. Yeah, so I mentioned that before about that because it's very relevant in the case of things like the ethics of abortion and also, you know, many other things like IVF and contraception and all kinds of things. Okay, so the question here is whether these things take place at the same time or not. Okay, one thing to remember, of course, is that it is taken over from a Brahmanical view. So I think it would be overburdening the passage to insist on too precise a definition. Okay, so we don't want to make it mean something that it wasn't actually intended to mean in the first place. Right? So the main point which the passage is making is that these things are actually, you know, necessary conditions for rebirth to take place, right? The fact that it has to be the parents, the mother has to be fertile, and that there has to be some consciousness, right? That's the main point. Is it making a point that those things have to all be there at the same time, right? Maybe, maybe not. It's certainly not making that point very clearly or emphatically, right? They do have to be there. When it says the union of those three things, the Pali is, I'm not quite sure what the Pali is, let's just have a look at it. The Pali is... Pali is here. Where are we? Tianang Sannipata. Okay, so the coming together of those three things. The literal Sannipata, together, sun, and Nipata is to literally to fall down together, to all with the coming together of those three things. How would you translate that with the union, coming together, something like that? In any case, it's certainly not emphasizing the fact that they have to happen all at the same time. And one of the things, of course, about conception is that conception doesn't all happen at one time, right? I mean, conception is a process, and it happens over quite an extended period of time, at least several hours. So there's not like an idea that there has to be sort of one point in time when birth has to take place and all those elements are there. But there's a process, and all of those things have to be part of the process. Again, you just think about that kind of organic nature of things. You think about, for example, in the Bhava Sutra, it talks about the seed and the field and so on, right? And so, yes, all of those things have to be there. The field has to be there, the seed and the moisture and other conditions as well, the sun and all of those things. But they don't have to be in any particular exact relationship, right? You can keep the seed in storage for years on end and then throw it on the seed, and then a month later it rains. So they don't necessarily have to be, in any particular exact relationship in time. It's mainly that they're just necessary conditions. Yeah. So I used to read that passage as saying that all of those things had to be present at exactly the same time, but these days I'm not convinced that that's what it means. Yeah. Sorry, we had a question.
The term Gandhava, is it used commonly in other suttas? For example, in the Metta Sutta, it says the born and the unborn, or the born and yet to be born, and the seen and the unseen. Were similar terms used to Gandhava in those suttas, or is it rarely used, this term?
The word Gandhava is very rarely used in this sense. In fact, I'm only aware of it being used in this sense in this particular context. So it's a bit of a mystery, and it presumably is a word which is, had some cultural context that people would understand it. Like I said, drawn from explicitly a Brahmanical point of view. We don't have to infer that it was a Brahmanical point of view. The suttas outright state that this view was the view of the Brahmins. So in the Metta Sutta, the word is sambhavesi, which is interpreted in the traditions as having the same meaning as Gandhava, but it's a different word. Yeah, sambhavesi means being to be born. The whole kind of background to the word Gandhava is a very interesting one, and it's a very complex one. And there's a wonderful essay by Vijayasekara about 50 years ago. Someone did an essay on Gandhava and pointed out many of the connotations that the word has in different contexts. Essentially, seemed to have been often conceived of as a deity who had some association with rebirth in different kinds of ways. So, kind of like used in a kind of a loose or idiomatic form. Yeah. Yes, Ainsley. Can we say that everyone, whether human or animal, is reborn? Is every birth a rebirth? Oh, you mean can some beings be new, never been born before? Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. How wide does it go? The suttas are actually silent on that point. It seems to be mostly assumed that yes, it's always a rebirth. But it's never outright stated. Yeah. Yeah.
This is about rebirth. I missed the last talk on rebirth, unfortunately. Mm. But this has puzzled me for a long, long time, is that I'm not sure how exact it is, but I've heard that in Buddhism that people can be reborn as animals or insects. And yet you've just stated that if you plant a mango seed, that only a mango can grow. We can't grow a lemon or another thing. Mm. And that consciousness evolves. The Buddha says that consciousness evolves. So evolution is a forward thing. And I find it very... I can't understand how we can... the concept of, you know, no matter how bad we are, that we can be reborn as an animal or an insect.
Okay. Well, first of all, evolution isn't a forward thing, certainly in biology. No biologist would say that. Evolution doesn't mean things get better. It just means things that change and adapt to circumstances.
But the human realms, we've come forward. Suppose, I mean, science, that we've actually evolved from, you know, so called from apes or whatever, that it's, you know, doesn't mean...
Are humans better than apes?
Well, it doesn't mean that. I don't mean better, but the actual, the DNA of an insect is totally different from the DNA of a human being.
Still not sure exactly what the problem is. Is the problem that you...
I just find I can't... I don't know how to accept that. That we can... The DNA...
Yeah.
That, you know, our DNA is a human being and that if we are reborn, no matter how bad we are, that our DNA can change to that of an insect.
Our DNA is not changing. I'm talking about DNA. It's just a metaphor. It's got nothing to do with actual DNA.
Yeah, but again, you did mention the seed of a mango...
Yeah.
Actually cannot come back, cannot, if you plant the seed of a mango, that you cannot have a lemon tree growing.
Sure.
Or something else growing, and that to me means the same thing, that we've been planted as seeds as human beings.
Right.
And that we cannot be reborn as an animal or an insect. That's what I struggle with.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, this is like the changeability of things. So remember that the think about it this way: a mango seed can't become anything other. Sorry, once if you plant a mango seed, it can't be anything other than a mango. That's true, right? On the other hand, the mango seeds are related to lemons, right? And if you go trace it far enough back in evolution. They come from the same place. Right? Things do change that radically. DNA has, in fact, changed that radically from being chimpanzees to being humans, although, in fact, there's almost no DNA differences between chimpanzees and humans. But to being a fish or a squirrel or a daffodil, right? DNA has in fact changed through all of those things. So what we're talking about, the DNA, is just a pattern. So yes, it takes longer to change, right? Longer in time to change. So it's not a perfect metaphor, okay? So it's just a metaphor, right? But the mind is the mind moves faster. So think about this also in terms of your body, right? Just again, in Buddhism, we always come back to what we can observe, right? What we can know directly. As you go through the day, right, your body can change a bit, right? It might feel more energetic at one time or more sleepy at another time or something like that. But it doesn't change that much during the day. On the other hand, your mind can change quite radically, right? You can be really angry at one point and do really nasty things, and the next point be really loving and really kind and do really wonderful things, right? That's the karma that you're making. And because your mind is more changeable, it's lighter, it's faster than your body is, so that the karma can lead to greater diversity of results.
Did the Buddha actually talk about it? Has there been any proof of that? That whole concept of coming back as an animal or an insect, did the Buddha actually talk about that? Or is that just a Brahmin, you know, because it's a belief system?
No. That's something that's talked about all the time in the suttas. It has all these different realms of rebirth and things like that. But in terms of the evidence, if you were here in the last workshop, that's one of the things that we actually mentioned and raised, is that when people remember different past lives, that in the vast majority of cases that we have, they recall past lives as human beings. And it's very difficult to find cases that people recall past lives as anything else. Now, that could be because, in fact, we are just born in the human realm. Okay, that could be one reason why. Or it could be that when, if let's say if I was a crocodile in my past life, then if I get reborn in this life when I'm a kid, how do I interpret a crocodile's experience, right? How do I say I was like this in my past? I don't, the memories and perceptions and so on which I had in that past life wouldn't make sense in that kind of way. So we couldn't interpret them. It's hard enough to establish or get any evidence for rebirth as a human. Even more difficult to do it if you're in other realms. Having said which, there are some cases of people who do talk about rebirth in different realms, but it's much rarer and much harder to sort of really establish that evidence than it is in the case of human rebirth.
In the book of Jim Tucker, Return to Life, there is one case of a snake which is reborn as a child.
Okay.
And the child has a very strange disease, very rare disease.
Okay.
Which is a skin, which looks like a snake.
Okay.
And he does remember who killed him when he was a snake. And when the man appears, he becomes very angry with this person.
Okay.
Alors, oh, he's a very little child.
Yeah.
So there are recorded cases of rebirths from animal to...
I can accept from animal to human, but I find it difficult to accept the other way around, backwards.
Yeah, sure. Sure. And like I said, you know, I think, you know, we have to, you know, we have to accept that there simply isn't as much evidence for that as there is human-to-human rebirth. So, you know, to me, it's very much an open question. Yeah. I should probably leave. There's more to be talked about there, but I might just leave that for now because we're getting on. Time's getting on a little bit. I had one more one more question here, please.
Oh, I just wanted to add to that. There was a sutta mentioned the month before last about the aesthetic who had the consciousness of a dog. He was acting like a dog,
right,
and doing everything like a dog. And then the Buddha said, because that was his mind state, that his consciousness would persevere, I guess, and his next rebirth he would be born a dog.
And the dog, yeah.
So it seemed like the mental, you know, the constructing activities of the mind was also a determining factor. Perhaps?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, that could almost be said to reinforce that position because that's actually very unusual behaviour, right? It's pretty extreme. So, yeah. Yes.
In the Jataka stories, it also mentions that the Buddha was different types of animals in past lives.
Sure, yeah. Yep. Okay, we'll just move on through this sort of, because I'm conscious that we're running over time already, and we're just in the first session, and so I'd like to get to the end of this particular section because there's a particular significance to this. Okay, so then she gives birth. When the child grows up, his faculties mature. When he grows up and his faculties mature still further, the youth enjoys himself provided and endowed with the five kinds of sensual pleasure: forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, smells cognizable by the nose, flavors by the tongue, touches by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. When he sees a sight with the eye, he lusts after it. If it's pleasing, he dislikes it. If it's unpleasing, he lives with mindfulness of his body, unestablished with a limited mind, and does not understand the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, where these bad, unskillful dhammas cease without remainder. And he delights in those feelings. Delight gives rise to grasping. Grasping gives rise to being. Being gives rise to birth gives rise to aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. So this is how that round of dependent origination is continued. And I just wanted to point out a few things about this. First thing about it to understand, and we'll look at this again later on, is how thoroughly this is rooted in a model of childhood development. Okay? This is perhaps the earliest ever sort of psychological model of childhood development, which you find in any ancient literature. Okay, these days we're very, you know, we think it's normal to think about different stages of childhood development, but this is the first time that it's ever described in any kind of detail. Notice how prominent the role of play is in childhood development. Yeah? It's very interesting, isn't it? Yeah? That's how the child's consciousness forms, through playing. And something which, certainly when I'm teaching in some Buddhist cultures, like places like Singapore and places, they want to throw play out and just get the kids to study all the time. And I'm always telling them, I always tell the kids, don't do your homework, don't do extra classes. I tell them, look at me, I dropped out of uni and I turned out fine, right? And I don't know why, but the parents never bring the kids back to see me again. I'm not sure what's going on there, but anyway. But seriously, isn't it? We forget these things. Actually, that's how children learn. They learn by playing. And so this gradual evolution as you're growing up, where your senses are maturing, and you start to be able to make these choices and these ethical choices, right, to pursue certain things or like certain things and not like certain things and so on. And that's how you're continuing the round of dependent origination, right? It's not the kids who are doing that, right? Again, important to understand, if we think of dependent origination as happening in an organic sphere, right, and through the cycle of life, right, it's not kids who are making good and bad karma because they don't understand what the role of ethics is, right? Children, animals, and so on, if they make any karma, probably they make a bit of karma, but probably not very much, right? Well, it's only when you're grown up and mature and you know what's right and wrong and you know how to make responsible ethical decisions, that's when you're fueling the round of rebirth, right? So this is kind of gradual sort of growth, this organic process in it. And again, just to point out that in a lot of the traditions, when these things are explained, they lose sight of this, and they don't talk about childhood development, and they don't talk about the organic roots of dependent origination, and it becomes all very philosophical and very abstract. But this is just talking about life; it's how the process of life goes. And so, if we want to understand it, we have to look at actually what happens as we grow older and how we get caught up in these things, right? And this is what happens. And you grow older, you become a teenager, you get infatuated by things, caught up in sex and drinking and drugs and all of these things, and you don't think about it. You don't think about the escape from it. You don't think about what are the drawbacks of these things. You just get involved. And then by the time you turn around, there you are, you've got married and you've got kids and you've got a mortgage, and then you're like, well, what am I going to do now, right? And then your life is, okay, got to try and keep these things going, and then next time, then you're getting old, and then you're going to die, and then it's next time. And you're around again, and you're like, oh. And then you go back, and you're like, who am I? What am I? Where did I come from? What am I doing here? Right? Right? And so this is what it is. This is what it's pointing to, this existential condition that we have. Okay, you're going round and round. And that's how it gives rise to suffering. And of course, it wouldn't be the Buddha's teachings if it also didn't show us the way out of suffering. And when the Buddha appears in the world and it goes on to teach in detail the gradual training, which we don't have time to do, of course, here. But basically, so you hear the teaching, go forth, practice meditation, practice the jhanas, and then you have insight and become free from your attachments, such as the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So this is the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta, and there's a lot more to it which we haven't been able to look at this afternoon. These are the main things that I wanted to look at with this, was that to see how it raises those existential questions and how we can understand our teachings of karma, we can do good, we can do bad, and we can understand these and we can try to do better and try to make better karma. But as long as we're within that realm of karma, then we're participating in the realm of samsara, and we don't understand, as it really is, the nature of freedom from that round of samsara. Okay, so that's already significantly over time for this session, so let's have our first break. We can have a cup of tea or whatever, and let's be back here. We're supposed to be back here by 2:30, so that's 5 minutes. So hurry. No, we should be a little bit flexible. We'll be back here by, let's say, 10 to 3. Does that sound reasonable? 10 to 3, yeah.